prospects. Who will give me money? They have got the greatest common sense, which you and I do not have at all. So we have the least common sense. If common sense will be all on and all, then by lock, we will have all been locks.
Without key.
So that we can neither open nor shut. That is the thing. We have been all right right now. So, this is lock, L-O-C-K-E-E-B is there. It is not to be pronounced. A person who is a teacher in philosophy, and when I was there as an expert in Public Service Commission, he pronounced it as loke. Loke. And he was dismissed for that. You go out, he said. You see. He pronounced. But he is, even now, a professor in philosophy. What can I do for that? Am I to be blamed? Because I was there. I was there. And he said, then the man in the chair, he said, well, then you can go, my friend. That's all. It's just like this. He pronunciation, lock, instead of lock, he said, loke. L-O-C-K-E. Loke. Okay. Just he thought it was just on the pattern of okay. Okay. He said, loke. He said that way. And he was dismissed from that hall and he went back. But fortunately for him, he is today a professor of philosophy. And I don't know what he must be teaching. But let him teach whatever he likes, you see. But that law was known for a broad common sense. And what did he do? A broad common sense would say, well, these are some rotten eggs. Will you have it? Keep it in the basket. I shall see how they were dissolved. And then he will put two or three rotten eggs along with good eggs also. And cheat the cheater. And then part with money. That will be the tricks. That is common sense, you see. If you have no ticket while traveling, then you just ask your friend, how long are you going? You see, I say. And he gives you to just to read, I am going to Bombay. All right, you pocket it. And this. And you receive, and you go in the next compartment. So that you have received. That is the common sense. But this is the common sense which is known as common sense in the modern world. In the recent past, not many, but even today, this is known as common sense. So many people teach me, you don't know the tact. What is meant by tact? I don't know. Tact means the cleverness to deceive others. Cheat others. That is known as tact, T-A-C-T, tact. This is the common sense. This is what Locke did. He said, everything is all right. Oh. This requires nothing very long. Courage, no need, nothing absolutely. Locke is the least, I say, man, clever man in the world. I have very little respect for him, except that he was a British philosopher and is considered to be at the beginning of the empiricist philosophers, Locke, Berkeley, and him. What, mind is real? Yes, mind is real. Matter is real? Yes, all right. God is real? Yes, all right. Matter, mind, God, everything in the world, this desk is real? Yes. This metal is real? Yes. Locke would say everything else in the world is real. And your eyes and everything is real. All. What is that real? Ideas, nothing but. All ideas. Whether you have got an idea of dirt, whether you have got an idea of a good smiling face of a beautiful woman, or whether you have got the idea of a vision of God, everything is real. So that ends the matter. Why should you talk with Locke at all? You see, he is an empiricist. But one great thing which he did was that he talked about God at least. And he didn't say that the idea of God is unreal. That is a great benefit. You see, mad ukar hai hamare paas. He didn't say that God is unreal. He said God also is unreal. Because by way of concession, you see. He didn't know. And if he is still alive, he would know. Followers of Locke will never know that God is there. You see. So leave apart. I go further. Why should we waste time upon Locke? Then Berkeley came. Berkeley was a bishop. Just as I spoke about Thomas Aquinas, similar is the case with this Berkeley. Now Berkeley thought that something is wrong in Locke. And what is that wrong? He thought that matter must not be there. So he found fault not only with Locke, but with also Spinoza. Spinoza said matter is as real as thought. Matter is as real as mind. So Berkeley thought, because he was a bishop, and unless he makes his followers, directs him to God, then there will be revolt in the church, and he will be dismissed. He will have no bishop's power. But probably Berkeley must also have inherited some common sense from Locke, and said that I must guard my position and my profession. So what he did was to eliminate matter from his philosophy. He said, unthought matter is abracadabra. Now, we may have him anything, abracadabra. What does it mean? It means absolutely nothing. Abracadabra. I say, it's nonsense, some nonsense, you see. It means nothing. Unthought matter cannot exist. Then what is that unthought matter? Unthought by whom? Unthought by man? No, my friend. It may be not thought by man, but it is thought by God. And he gives a very example of a tree in the desert. And a tree, a lonely tree, a solitary tree, suppose. In the desert there is one tree. Then that is matter. That is not thought of by anybody except the camel travelers. You see. Who knows whether they avoid the tree or go by a different route? I am not thinking of that thing, and nobody thinks. And then they would ask Berkeley, why do you think? Is that tree real or not? And your proposition is unthought matter is unreal. This tree in that desert is thought by none in the world. So is it real or not? Yes, it is real. And why? Because God has thought it. Berkeley would give his answer. And if he would not give his answer, then he would be dismissed from the church. You are not a fit bishop. You see. Therefore he said, God looks at this universe, God at this solitary being. It is God who thinks of this solitary thing, though not man. So he cancelled matter altogether and retained mind. But whose mind? Is it man's mind? If it is man's mind, then why does not a man think of that tree? Then he said nothing. He said, it is God's mind who is thinking of this tree. You see. Unperceived matter does not exist, but perceived matter does exist. Perceived matter does exist. This is perceived, this tree is perceived by God, therefore it exists. So he gave a priority to the God's mind and to the existence of all things in the world, a secondary importance. So Berkeley has thought not on account of his zeal for philosophy, but on account of his profession. You see, as a bishop, that God must exist. If God will not exist, I shall not exist, and I shall not fill my belly. Therefore, he was constrained to say that matter does not exist. Unperceived matter does not exist. Then perceived matter exists because it is perceived by God. That is, this tree is dependent for its existence and for its being conceived on some other mind, namely God, and it is God that exists. So Berkeley also made room for going for the God from thought and from perceived matter, from thinking and from perceived matter he went to God. So all minds point to God. All thoughts, all our thoughts, human thoughts lead to God, and all matter which is perceived by God lead to God. Therefore God exists in his system also. Now this has given a chance for the skeptic David Hume, and I told you that he is one of the most honest men in the world. Of all the range of philosophy, in the range of all of history, I do not find such a straightforward man as David Hume, though I do not accept his philosophy. He found a clue in Berkeley. What was that clue? Oh, Berkeley has succeeded in destroying matter. Let me destroy mind also. And he destroyed by a contrivance. You see. And the contrivances are too many. As many as your thinking affords. He said, if matter goes away, if unperceived matter goes away, then what about this thought? Thinking about what? Thinking about what? Thinking about your own thoughts again. Moving round and round your thoughts. So he said, it is not possible. You must have an object. But if there is no object at all, then what is your thinking? About what are you thinking? You will say, perhaps I am thinking about myself. Then he will say, have you got an idea or not? Idea of this table. I do not see this table. Now I have seen this table, let it go away. It is kept in my mind as an idea. This table goes away, no doubt. But even after this destruction of the table, I have got an idea of the table. But of this table, meaning what? That idea is dependent upon the impression caused on the retina of my eyes by this table so long as it was with me in presence. So that corresponding to your ideas, there are impressions. And what makes things real? If your idea, for example, is to be correct, then it must have a corresponding impression. Why do you talk of God? You can talk about that tree. Yes, I have seen that tree. And now I look on this side. I have got an idea of that tree. Because the impression, the original impression is there. And I have got the idea of that impression in my head. So my concepts are nothing but the copies of the impressions of the impression. About God, can you say that you have seen God? Nobody has seen God. For that idea which has not an original impression is mind-framed and therefore unreal. It is only your speculation and therefore unreal. There is no impression corresponding to it, therefore it is unreal. That is all. And immortality, about that also I have no idea, no impression. Immortality. Has any man come from the angels or from the heaven? Has Menaka met us and I am immortal? Has she said it? No, nothing at all. I am no immortality. So I have no idea about immortality. That is also a foolish thing. Because there is no corresponding impression. That thing can be real which has an earlier impression as its original. And if God has no impression, then God's idea is unreal. The idea of immortality is unreal. The idea of freedom is immortal, unreal. God, freedom and immortality being unreal, then what is it that is spiritual in nature? There is nothing spiritual. There is no God. Just as I told you on the first day, that a head of a department of a reputed university speaks that I have not known as yet what is meant by spiritual. Meaning, he cares only for that day, first day of the month. That's a very fat salary he gets, about 2,000 to 3,000 rupees. And wherever he goes by air. So naturally, why should he care about God? Is it not? To care about God is the ill fate of persons who are poor. Is it not? Who are in the hospital, they may think about God, but why I am so strong and sturdy and fat and getting my salary, why should I care about God? I should care at the most about the university. Kya wo aaj first tarikh hai, aaj tankha milega ki nahi? That is all. This is all right, this is sufficient for me. Why should I care about God at all? God does not come and pay me my salary. It is the university which pays me, draws a check and he gives it. It is sufficient for me. At the most I should care for the increments, and very easy increments for not doing work, you see. That is all right. And without God, we are doing it, because we are the masters. That is what Hume said. So Hume destroyed everything, you see. And with the destruction of Hume, not only he has destroyed the empirical evidence of all science and the whole of the science, but also the speculations, because they are already cobwebs. They were spread. Phew! Aise karne se ud jata hai. So even with the least, you see, gusts of the wind, it is thrown away. So Descartes, Spinoza and Leibniz will be blown away by a single gust of wind. And the empirical sciences and all this structure will be blown away by our argument. So David Hume made destruction of everything else. And it is upon this destruction that we shall see tomorrow how Kant constructed a building of his own. Thank you.
And friends, it has been a very absorbing address
by Professor Date. I was all the time observing how you all were spellbound during various stages of his lecture. And of course, he by his magic created such an atmosphere as if we were surrounded by God everywhere for a few minutes when he was dealing with Spinoza. And with the same magic, he has talked about the empiricists and has with them blown off God, as it were. So it is all due to the eloquent and magical powers of Professor Date's speech that we were with God and we for a time felt that God is evaporated. Well, tomorrow, as he promised, he will come to Kant, who is a restorer of our faith in God, freedom and immortality. So we are eagerly awaiting tomorrow's lecture. And I think I am echoing your feelings when I am telling this. So tomorrow again, we meet at 8:15. Thank you very much. Professor Date and ladies and gentlemen, I again welcome you all for the fourth lecture on the fourth day by Professor Date. He has dealt with those who are attending the lectures for the last 3 days. He has covered a vast field and come up to Hume so far as Western philosophy is concerned. And today, as he told us yesterday, he will take up the philosophy of Kant, the greatest philosopher of the Western countries. I now request Professor Date to deliver his address.
His colleagues and his students of the Department of Philosophy, ladies and gentlemen. I have not traversed, you see, the field of Western philosophy as yet. It will take probably today, tomorrow, and perhaps the day after tomorrow also. After that, there will be Indian philosophy, and after that, the backbone of all philosophies, namely the spiritual life. So, I don't know exactly how many lectures will be there. Today, however, I am much afraid to speak upon a great philosopher. Kant is like the Himalayan mountain, and those who are mountaineers would alone be able to go up to the top of the mountain. Others will come down, either by the slope of the mountain itself or by the inability to go to climb upwards. Today is the most difficult task for me to do. And I have not touched Kant or revised my knowledge about the philosophy of Kant for the last 17 years, 1963. I shall place before you only what I remember. And as the intellect of a man becomes, if you can say, covered with dust, or is rusted, as you should say, above to 60, mine also will not be an exception to it. With all these limitations, I shall place before you something which I know absolutely, about which I am absolutely certain. And I have not done the sin of bluffing at any time of my life. So I shall not tell you anything which is absurd or which is wrong. I shall tell you only about which I am certain and what is correct. Kant, I
according to me, is one of the greatest of philosophers the world has ever produced. He saw the American War of Independence. He saw the 7 Years' War, which made Germany a free nation. He saw the French Revolution. He saw the smashing down by Napoleon of many of his enemies, by marching up and down the entire continent of Europe. And yet, a weak-hearted, a small-statured man in Königsberg, in the northeast of Germany, an unknown province even at that time, was Kant. He was born in Königsberg and he died in Königsberg. He lived for 81 years, and yet throughout his long life he didn't go out of the radius of 5 miles from the place where he was born. He was precise to even a second of a time. He didn't waste his time even for a moment, you see. He's getting up, he's drinking coffee, he's lecturing, he's studying, he's writing. Everything has its fixed time. And the neighbors knew that it must have been exactly at 4:30 when he came down from his house and walked in his grey black coat with a Spanish cane in his hand and walked to and to his car. And that was also for exactly time. And people knew that, and they would wind their watches. Such was the great man, they say. So he was precise in everything, accurate in everything. And man who has no accuracy and precision cannot do anything in life. I am certain about it. So Kant was like that. Now he wrote his first Critique of Pure Reason at the age of 54, remember. 54. Till then he was toiling in understanding the problem of philosophy and how to solve it. He didn't solve the problems for others, he solved it for himself. I yesterday told you that there was a war between the rationalists on the one hand and the empiricists on the other. What was the cause of it? And he said, one didn't know the other. The rationalists didn't understand the problem before the empiricists and vice versa. And that was the problem before Kant. Can we just bring about the marriage between the rationalists and the empiricists? Reconcile them together. And he found at first that it was an impossible task, because the rationalists produced an imaginary cobweb, as I told you, and the empiricists rested entirely upon observation and experiment of the sensible data. There was nothing common between the two. One was looking to the east and another was looking to the west. How can they meet at all? You see, that was the problem. And yet he thought and thought about this problem for a number of years and came to the conclusion that they must be brought together somehow. Not arbitrarily, but by way of reasoning. And just see, if you understand the problem before Kant, we have understood Kant, I should say. Many a time we do not understand what we want, and so we do not understand the solution of it. The solution of the problem lies in understanding the problem. Prince Bismarck has said it. If you do not understand the problem, create a problem for yourself and make it so difficult that you will be puzzled, and then break that problem into two and break the half of it again into two, and in that way make it so small that you can solve bit by bit the entire problem. It was exactly the precision which the German philosopher Kant had before him. He saw that the rationalists were right in one way and the empiricists were also right in one way. But he also saw that there must be something wrong with the rationalists and something wrong with the empiricists. What was that wrong? And there lies the problem for him. The problem for him is the most difficult thing which one must understand first. I shall say it in his own words, in synthetic a priori judgment. Now this appears to be as a boulder in your understanding, before your understanding, that how can a synthetic a priori judgment, every word of which is difficult to understand, synthetic, a priori, and judgment. How can there be a synthetic a priori judgment? There can be an analytic a priori judgment, there can be a synthetic a posterior judgment, but how can there be a synthetic a priori judgment? One thing of one and another thing of another, how can they mix together? How can milk be mixed with wine? Mixed with water can be, yes, all right. Wine with water will be all right. But how can milk and wine go together? How can a priori judgments become synthetic at the same time? I shall tell you in simple words and not confuse you more, you see. Of course, where you do not understand, it will be my fault and not yours, you see. Because I have not revised, as I told you, my knowledge of the philosophy of Kant during the last 17 years, you see. So whatever the defect will be there in your understanding, it will be due to me rather than to your understanding. But I shall be, cover up my ignorance and show that I am a wise man, you see. So the analytic a priori or the synthetic a posteriori can be understood. I shall give examples, simple examples of them, and you will understand what is meant by a priori analytic judgment. Take the case of a definition of a triangle. A triangle is a three-sided rectilinear figure. What are you doing here? A triangle, if I repeat the thing, triangle, 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 100 times and 1,000 times, you will not understand what it is. But if I say that it is a rectilinear figure, a rectilinear three-sided figure, then you immediately understand. What am I doing here? I am analyzing the concept of triangle by giving the predicate, namely a three-sided rectilinear figure. If I say Socrates is Socrates, Socrates is Socrates, Socrates 100 times, you will not understand. But if I say Socrates is an Athenian, is a native of Attica, he was a philosopher, he was going to the forum at exactly at the same time, and he drank hemlock, then of course you understand something about history. So the predicate is nothing but the analysis of the subject term. And in that way, if I say a triangle is a three-sided rectilinear figure, it is a judgment. Judgment means a proposition, a sentence, you see. That is nothing more than judgment. It's a big word for a small concept, a judgment. Judgment means what you judge by the intellect. So a triangle is a three-sided rectilinear figure. A three-sided rectilinear figure is the analysis of the concept triangle. So it becomes a priori analytic judgment. You have analyzed it. You have then made a judgment that is a proposition, and it is a priori, means without reference to any actual triangle, a blackboard or a piece of a triangular ground. You have not seen a piece of a triangular ground. You have not seen a triangle drawn on a blackboard, but you have simply come in contact with the Euclidean definition of a triangle, that a triangle is a three-sided rectilinear figure. That is sufficient for me. Have you understood what is meant by triangle? Yes. What is it? A three-sided rectilinear figure. This is a priori, means without looking to the blackboard, without measuring the ground, as a triangular piece of land, and you say it is an analytic judgment. It is an analytic sentence, a sentence which consists of analysis and which consists of something which without going to the measurement of the triangle or to looking at the blackboard. This is what is known as a priori analytic judgment. Now what is meant by synthetic a judgment? Synthetic a posterior judgment. A posterior means after. Nothing very difficult. Instead of big word, you can see a synthetic after the perception, after observation, after experiment. You have made observation, you have observed, you have measured, you have experimented upon the things, and then you have come to a sort of judgment. But this judgment will be after you have opened your eyes. You see, not your mind, not your intellect, but your senses. You have become now an empiricist. I give another example, just to illustrate this. If I say gold is yellow, gold is yellow. You are not having the two concepts, gold and yellow. There are two concepts. You are not analyzing now gold. You are not having a definition of gold. You are not having a definition of yellow as a color. You are having synthesizing two concepts. But it is not in the mind, gold is yellow. You are actually seeing a metal. You are actually seeing that it is a color and gold is yellow. Is gold yellow? Then the brass also is yellow, gold? No. Because brass has got a separate specific gravity, gold has got a specific
another specific gravity. So a material which has got a specific gravity is at the same time yellow. Is at the same time yellow. That is the meaning which we have about gold. Here you are synthesizing, bringing together two concepts, not in your mind simply, but in by observation. That is, you are seeing actually before your eyes a metal. And you don't know what is this name, and somebody tells you it is gold. Why? Because it is yellow. Not because it is yellow so much, but because it has got a specific gravity which no other metal in the world has got. That is the thing. So a metal which has got a particular specific gravity is, and which is at the same time yellow, is called gold. So here you are not analyzing the concept of gold, we are bringing and you are bringing together certain concepts by observation and experiment. So if an alchemist does, for example, something, iron into gold, or you can say some brass into gold or copper into gold, you will just see whether it has got the specific quality or not, specific gravity or not. And you find that it is not gold, it is counterfeit. You will throw it away, you see, because it is not gold. Meaning you are here but doing what? You are having a posterior examination by means of observation and experiment of certain coexisting facts. Coexisting facts, you see. That is, if a man, for example, breathes well, if a man, for example, has his heart beats are well, if there is a proportion of 4-1 in the breathing and the heart beats, you see, if there is a pinch, then he feels that some sort of pain, then of course you can say that he is alive. Here you make observation and experiment with that man, and you hold a piece of cotton at his nose, and if it moves or not, so that you will have different tests, whether he is alive or not. So that the doctor will bring, and you will see the eyelids, whether the eyelids, if they are staring or not, they are not moving at all. So different observations are there. And on account of that, you will say the man is alive, the man is dead. So this is a judgment after observation and experiment. It is from the side of the empiricism. So empiricism would be content by saying that it is a synthetic a posterior judgment. The rationalist would be content by saying that it is a priori judgment, analytic a priori judgment, and synthetic a posterior judgment. But Kant's problem is how to bring these together. It should be synthetic as well as a priori at the same time. I have explained to you what is meant by analytic a priori judgment. I have explained to you what is meant by synthetic a posterior judgment. But Kant says this is not enough. They will be warring still. There will be a war between the two. The opposite camps are there. One doesn't understand what another man speaks, you see. And therefore they go on with their harping upon their own. So this is, can't say, then no. Both of them must come to a common understanding, namely that no knowledge is possible. Just see, no knowledge is possible according to Kant unless we have synthetic a priori judgment. One element drawn from the empiricist is synthetic, and another element a priori drawn from the rationalists. The rationalists say that you go on with concepts only. Concepts. And from God, omnipresent, omniscient, etc., kind-hearted, and anything you may say about. Now this is an analysis only of the concept of God. How do you say that He is there? In your adversity, if He comes to your help and relieves your anxieties, then say, yes, I have observed. I know that He is grace, He has got grace, etc. Then, of course, God will be there. Otherwise not. Otherwise, Hume's discovery or Hume's analysis will be absolutely correct. Kant says Hume will be absolutely correct when he says that the idea must have a corresponding previous impression. Show me the impression of which it is a copy. God is a concept. Has that concept got a corresponding impression? Have anybody seen God so that I can say that I have got an idea of God? That was Kant's conclusion. So he says, Hume will be the last word in philosophy. Skepticism, we shall come to skepticism only. And Hume has smashed on both sides. He has done away with the rationalists, and he has done away with the empiricists. And Kant says, yes, Here I am, a bear on heap of destruction only. How can I save ourselves from the destruction of whom? He said beautifully, it is by whom, it is whom who has roused me from my dogmatic slumber. Kant was roused by whom and not by anybody else. Not by Plato, not by Aristotle, not by the whole, you can say, of the rationalist school, Descartes, Spinoza, no. They have dogmatically asserted something, they have analyzed something, and these men have refused to analyze. These men are depending only upon observation and experiment. What do you observe? Upon what basis? How do you know that it is correct what we have observed? You are observing, for example, the mirage. Can you say that the mirage is right? It is an illusion. We have seen a serpent on a rope. Can you say that we have observed the serpent? It is an illusion. If such illusions occur in your observation and experiment on account of the defect of the instruments which you use, on account of the damaging of your eyes, or on account of the fluctuations in the objects, then what sort of evidence is there in saying that I am observing? There may be defects due to the eyesight, there may be defects due to the instruments which you use, there may be defects in the methods which you use, and there must be the fluctuations or changes in the object itself which you observe. And on that account, the empiricist will be at fault, and there will be no clear understanding, no knowledge at all. Similarly, even on the rational side, you are imagining and imagining. Then you can imagine even, you can smell rats even in that way, and say that they are, no. You can imagine angels. You can, for a fact, you can have supernatural explanations. From the Virgin Mary, for example, had that child, Jesus, and an angel came and said, Joseph, you are all right, it is your child. A supernatural agency was brought about to account for a natural event, a biological event, you see. Such supernatural evidences, that are also useless. So the rationalists are wrong in one way, and the empiricists are wrong in one way. How are we to pre-prove that there should be a synthesis of the two, a combination of the two? Unless the rationalists come, leave their own premises, and the empiricists come and leave their premises and come to a common ground, there will be no knowledge at all. So how is knowledge possible? Then Kant says, by having a synthetic a priori judgment. Now I just say, I give an example from the third, that is of Kant's. Now the square and the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the two squares, if I say this. How do you know that this is correct? Then you can say 3 into 3, 9, 4 into 4, 16, 9 plus 16, 25, and the hypotenuse will be of 5, and 5 into 5 is equal to 25. You measure it, you measure the hypotenuse, you make a square of it, it is 25, you have the one side 4, you have another side at 3, have the squares upon them, 3, that is, so that it is analytically all right. Why analytically? You have it. You have it actually a piece of ground which is a triangular, a right angle triangle of hypotenuse measuring 5 at 3 and 4, and then you will find exactly it is the same. What I thought in my mind is exactly observed, is experimented upon. So what is it? There is an element of sense brought in, there is an element of reason brought in, and the reason and the sense are married together. Here, for example, in the case of a hypotenuse, the square of the hypotenuse is equal to the square of the sum of the squares of the two sides is correct. Not because I have analyzed it, but because of what I found by means of analysis is also observed, is observable. You see, is observable at any time by anybody in the world. And therefore this is correct. Now what sort of proposition have I? What sort of judgment have I now? Synthetic. Because the ground is there, it is measured. That is the sense element. And what is the a priori element? Yes, I have made the Euclidean proposition that the square on the hypotenuse is equal to some of these two squares. So this a priori knowledge of myself is said to be correct on account of being observed and observable at all times. You see, man, all men are mortal. Yes, I can understand it. But how? I have been seeing each and every man to be mortal. Have I gone to the whole end of the world? Some man may be an Ashwatthama, he may not die. You see, some man may be there who, you see, who actually are, what, how am I to prove it? He says, if a man has got a physical structure of his own, he must die. Meaning they must have something in common, and that common element is the synthetic a priori judgment. If you analyze, if you keep in mind these three propositions, namely that a triangle is a three-sided rectangular figure, gold is yellow, and the third proposition, as I said, was that the square on the hypotenuse is equal to the square of the two squares, then you have understood the problem of Kant. I do not think anybody will make it simpler than this to make you aware of what Kant has in his mind. So there is no knowledge possible without the synthesis of the a priori element and the sensuous element. The rational and the sensuous element must go hand in hand. As friends, not as aliens, not as warriors on two opposite sides, they will be wrangling throughout the world. That is Kant's solution also. The statement of the problem is itself the solution of the problem. Now where is it? I just go a little further. If you have understood this, I take it for granted that you have understood it. And if you have not understood it now, it is your fault, not my fault. You see? Because you have not been attentive, or you were unwilling to understand. You have it. So it is not my fault. Now I go further, a step further. And if you haven't understood it, you will not understand what I shall tell further. You see. Now, here, idealism. Now, he has stated in germ what he has to tell everything. His idealism consists, I am going to the first book of his, namely the Critique of Pure Reason. You see, I am only giving you an idea of what he has written at the age of 54 in his first book, great book, namely Critique of Pure Reason. You see, I am not going to his second book, namely Critique of Practical Reason, nor to his third book, the Critique of Judgment. You see, I am only dealing with the first of it. And if you understand the first, then the matter will be easy. If you understand the second and the third, there is not much difficulty about it. But this first is the most difficult of all, so far as Kant is concerned. His idealism. Now just see, if you understand his problem, then you will understand the whole of the Kantian philosophy. Idealism, the essence of all idealism lies, remember one sentence, from idea to transition from idea to reality. Transition from idea to reality. And that is what we have seen. The idea exists in my thought, in my head. It is a concept, and we have made the transition from idea to reality. Namely, what is actually happening in this world, which we can observe and experiment. So in the very statement of that problem which we have solved just now, there is the sense of his idealism. He has travelled from idea, which lies in the concepts and in our heads, which a rationalist thinks of, which he analyzes, and a priori method, he says, actually in there. Is it a transition from idea to reality? What exists actually? What can is observable and experimental? So his idealism also is there embedded in the very solution of the problem which he has for it. But in another way still, I should say, there is another element of idealism, namely his locating of things in space and time. His locating of space in space and time, remember. Every event is located in space, and every event is dated in time. There is nothing which cannot be dated in time and which cannot be located in space. Time and space go together. This is exactly, I don't know much about science, but this is exactly the principle which Einstein has for him. Time has a fourth dimension. Now we have length, breadth and thickness, but no, it is at the same time. Space alone will not explain. Time alone will not explain, you see, things. But space and time put together will explain things. And this was made in germ by a discovery made by Kant. As a matter of fact, you can also have another side of Kant's philosophy, that it was Kant who refuted all idealism. Mark that. I shall give an example which is very popular. He says, I have got $100 in my pocket, but they don't jingle in my pocket. Meaning, I have got an idea of what is meant by $100. Kant says, but do I have them actually? In reality, they do not jingle in my pocket. Therefore, there is no transition from the idea of $100 to the actual possession of the $100 in my pocket. I do not make the transition from idea to reality. In that way, he has attacked idealism, you see, in refutation of all idealism. Though this is wrong, he says, we cannot go from idea to reality. That is what he has said. And in spite of this, he is one of the greatest idealists. This is the paradox of it. One who goes to attack adores it. I am, for example, you see, I studied Bible because the missionaries criticized everything what was not. Just as a Muslim, for example, they burned the library at Alexandria, saying that whatever is contained in the Quran, then nothing can be outside. It will be either superfluous or it will be useless. Either it will be blasphemy or it will be of no use. Whatever is contained in Quran, if you find anything outside written, then it is superfluous. And whatever is not contained in the Quran, then it is blasphemy. Therefore, the whole Alexandrian library was burnt by these fanatics. Similarly, we can say that whatever is, Kant would have done the same thing. But Kant, no doubt, was an opponent of idealism. And in spite of his opponents,